You are listening to 90.1 FM, KKFI, Kansas City Community Radio. Stay tuned for the Heartland Labor Forum, radio that talks back to the boss. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum, a weekly show of news, information, and commentary by and for the working people of Kansas City. This show is produced by a team of volunteers from a broad range of workplaces and unions. The views expressed on the Heartland Labor Forum are ours and not necessarily those of KKFI or any unions involved.
Tonight's show is being underwritten by Boyd Kinner Thomason Parish, LLC, and American Postal Workers Union, Local 67. Boyd Kinner Thomas and Parish, LC, since 1983, our attorneys have aggressively represented the injured and have provided counseling to labor organizations throughout the area. We stand up for working families against those who would do them harm. American Postal Workers, Local 67, would like to wish all of our union brothers and sisters a joyous holiday season and a prosperous new year. We ask that while you are shopping for all your holiday needs, from decking the halls to presents under the tree, remember to buy union products and support American jobs and the working class. We remain dedicated to the fight for the 99% and the belief that our solidarity is stronger than the corporations that seek to strip our rights. The Heartland Labor Forum and KKFI thank our underwriters for their support. On tonight's show, if there was a blue wave in last week's elections, it missed Missouri's Democratic candidates. Tonight, we talked to Representative Darren McGee about prospects for working people in the Missouri legislature in 2019. Will they try to repass right to work? Then hear about Bob Moore and Bob's Red Mill. Whole Grain Foods put people before profits when he retired and the transferred ownership to his workers. We'll ask UMKC economics professor Eric Olson whether that's good enough. In the news, the AFL-CIO is very upbeat about last week's elections and get active in defending the First Amendment, says president of the union that represents journalists. Our feature at the end of the show is Know Your Rights from Angie Williams. Now for the news from our side.
The news from our side, Thursday, November 15th. Here's a very optimistic statement from AFL-CIO President Richard Trumka, summing up last week's election results and the future. Over the last few months, we've knocked on more than 2.3 million doors and distributed 5 million flyers at more than 4,600 work sites. That represents millions of conversations between fellow union members, talking earnestly about the opportunity we embrace in this election, a chance to stand up and demand the fairer economy and a more just society that we deserve. That issue-focused, member-to-member communication extended to every part of our organizational operation, from the 12-million-piece direct mail program to the largest digital ad campaign in our history. At the heart of every effort we've made, there's a powerful advantage unique to the labor movement. Working people trust our unions. In fact, persuadable voters trust unions more than any other source of political information, including friends and family. We earn that trust and build on it. mobilizing our members to the polls. The result was game-changing. We're filling the halls of power with our own. More than 900 union members were elected to office last week, including U.S. Senator, two governors, and at least 18 U.S. House of Representative members. We're also tossing out the hand-picked politicians who have dutifully served corporate interests at the expense of working families. It gave me no small pleasure waking up last Wednesday knowing that Scott Walker and Bruce Rauner will be packing their bags in the coming weeks. But it gives me even greater confidence knowing that we elected an army of pro-worker governors all across America, not just in Wisconsin and Illinois, but Nevada, Maine, and even Kansas. Working people took an important step last week, from the state houses and the governor's mansions to Capitol Hill. We are building the foundation for a brighter future, and we are ready to hold our elected leaders accountable to their promises and to do our part to win a pro-worker policy agenda. We're tired of a corporate-controlled government and a corporate-run economy. We aren't standing for politicians who listen to the whispers of a few CEOs and ignore the voices of working families. We're dismantling a broken system that expects us to work harder and longer and produce more wealth than ever before, but take home the same or even less. We're doing the work of ending that injustice. There is an energy unlike anything I've seen in my 50 years in the labor movement, an urgency to demand something better. We're organizing. We're marching. We're striking. We're fighting for our most fundamental rights and dignities on the job. And as we made it clear last week, we're making ourselves heard loud and clear at the ballot box.
BAI Union News Service reminds us that journalists are workers too. The president of their union, the Newspaper Guild, CWA, went even further. President Bernie Lunzer, upset by the increasing attacks on press freedom in general and reporters in particular, is asking his members and union members nationwide to pressure their lawmakers to stand up for freedom of the press. But in this case, he says, we are the ones being attacked. If we don't stand up for ourselves and our profession, then who will? And if journalists are no longer able to spread the truth, then only lies will remain. Of course, he is referring to last week when President Trump arbitrarily evicted CNN White House Bureau Chief Jim Acosta from a press conference and revoked his credentials. Then, of course, there was Trump's failure to do anything about the brutal murder by Saudi high officials of journalist Jamal Khashoggi. Khashoggi was a frequent contributor to the guild-represented Washington Post. But it's far more than that, Lunzer wrote. At least 40 journalists in the United States have been physically attacked while on the job. Four more were killed in their own newsroom, where another newspaper employee also died. Lunzer believes that his members need to step out and defend the First Amendment, especially from a president who hates journalists who ask tough questions. During his 2016 campaign, Trump penned in journalists in restricted areas, surrounded by threatening, howling mobs of Trumpites. Several news organizations had to hire security guards for their reporters due to the danger. Trump also insulted and berated journalists during the campaign, and T-shirts with the legend, Tree Noose Journalist, some assembly required, sold like hotcakes in his rallies. The campaign, the T-shirts with the... Lunzer concludes by saying that besides pressuring Congress, there's another way reporters and other media members can protect themselves against assaults by Trump, Trumpites, and their supporters. They can unionize. Only by standing with one another can we not only defend but improve the profession we love, he declared.
Amazon. Kansas Cityans can breathe a sigh of relief that the greatest headquarters competition is over and we didn't win. Already residents of Queens in New York City are demonstrating because they did, that is, win. It turns out the real winners will be real estate brokers. That's because the infusion of so many new tech workers in construction will end up eliminating housing and driving up rents. The Guardian reports people rallied yesterday across the street from the Long Island City site where Amazon's new campus is set to rise. It turns out that they had no say in it. The state of New York offered Amazon $5 billion in tax breaks and subsidies. Opponents claim Amazon will stress the neighborhood's infrastructure while doing little to help local residents. The subsidies are being routed through an economic development agency, so elected representatives will never get a chance to vote on the plan. Amazon has promised in a non-binding agreement to help fund a modest job training program and set aside space for tech startup incubator. Opponents say they need much more to make the deal worthwhile for the city, like help with the area's delayed, plagued subways, sewer systems that often back up, overcrowded schools, and scarcely affordable housing, I would guess it. The HuffPost reported that according to March 2018 report by Brookings Institution, state and local governments doled out up to $90 billion worth of subsidies to individual businesses each year. As cities compete to give away more tax revenue and larger incentive to companies, they may lose track of the line between investing in their communities and exploiting them. The news tonight was read by Greg Swartz and Michael Savoie.
On the day all the Democrats won, did you sigh and say our work is done? Did you feel at all angry or shocked that all your dreams could fit in a box? And on the day that they took back the House, did the homeless find shelter at last? Was it one man who stole their dignity? Or all those laws that the Democrats passed in the day that they counted the votes?
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. I'm Michael Savoie. Our show tonight is a recap of the midterm elections to focus on worker issues. My guest is State Representative Daron McGee, Missouri 36. Good evening, Representative McGee. Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum.
Good evening, Michael. Thank you for having me.
Well, thank you for showing up for us. It was my intent to try to take a look at the issues as they related to working people there. And let's start right off with the constitutional amendments. The so-called Clean Missouri amendment passed 2-1. What's its impact on workers in our state?
Well, it's going to allow workers to have a larger voice in government. One of the things that it does is it sets limits for contribution limits for folks who can donate to campaigns. So in the past, where we had no contribution limits, and one person could give $1 million to one guy running for state senate or state representative or the governor of the highest office in our state, whereas now you're limited to $2,500 per person. And I think that that is a win for workers because that means your voice is just as valued as the millionaire who lives in St. Louis or lives in southern Missouri, in southwest Missouri. And so, and also is a big change because now it is going to affect the way we redistrict our legislative seats. So before that we have a Republican dominated legislature, I think that is going to loosen the grip of this Republican dominated legislature where you're going to have some more fair and more competitive districts across the state because there'll be less gerrymandered districts that will impact working people greatly in this state.
Yeah, well, certainly I would agree with all that. You know, interestingly enough, the Kansas City Star on Tuesday had an editorial that suggested that the legislature is going to be coming after this. They don't like the will of the people, and they may find a way to circumvent that. Any insights there?
Well, I definitely think the Republican majority will try to chip away at the Clean Missouri Amendment, which is a constitutional amendment. I think they're going to try to chip away at it and subvert the will of the people because they want to maintain power. So I definitely think that will be an issue coming up in the next election.
Yeah, yeah. Well, one of the things I could appreciate about it was the gift limit and the time limit on returning to or leaving the legislature and becoming a lobbyist yourself. So obviously it's got to be good for Missouri working people. Of course, Amendment...
I would agree with that 100%. You know, one of the things that we've got to be focused on is that, you know the I hear from my colleagues in the legislature, they are very upset about the gift ban limit. Well, that didn't affect me at all because when I came to the legislature, I didn't take legislative gifts and I didn't take meals from lobbyists. And so that doesn't affect me at all because I was sent here to serve the will of the people. And so that's one thing that I've tried to do. If I can't afford it before I got elected and, you know, I should be able to eat or have a certain legislative gift once I've been elected. And so because I'm there ultimately to serve the people of my district in the 36th House District.
Yeah, I certainly wish more of your compadres saw it that way, my friend. Now, of course, Constitutional Amendment number 2 and 3 and 4-2 was medical marijuana, which was voted yes. Number 3 voted no, and number 4 voted yes. Are there any things there that could have a direct impact on Missouri workers?
Well, not necessarily on working people, but what Amendment 2 was sold as on the medical marijuana was sold as compassionate care for people who were terminally ill and for folks who have diseases that they're going to be wrestling with for the rest of their life and a way for them to adequately address their pain and their management of pain in their life without, you know, being hooked or addicted to opioids that a lot of times the people have to use when you talk about terminal illness. And so that is something that I think many Missourians supported the idea of being having the use of medical marijuana in the state.
Yep. Yeah, I would certainly agree with that. Of course, now here comes a hot-button issue, Proposition B, the minimum wage. Our legislature has been fighting against a bare minimum wage for some time. Of course, you know better than I. Kansas City and St. Louis approved such an increase. The state legislature outlawed it. We pass it again, vote of the people. Do you suspect they'll be knocking on the door again?
Well, that's absolutely right, Michael. And I think one of the things that we can expect looking at this legislature, you know, when you talk about earning a fair and livable wage for all Missourians, that is one issue that transcends politics, whether you're a Democrat, a Republican, an independent, or in the Green Party. Most people, most free-thinking people think that people who work, get up and go to work every day should earn a living wage for them and their families. And I think Missourians overwhelmingly supported that, and that is to show that we support Missouri workers. We rejected right to work in August on Prop A, and now you see with Prop B, we raised our minimum wage, which means we want workers to feel safe in their environment in which they work, and we want them to earn a livable wage for them and their families. And we want Missouri to be open for business, and that the way Missouri is going to be open for business is to treat their workers with the respect and dignity they deserve by allowing them to join a union if they so choose and by allowing them to earn a livable wage minimum wage in this state that's livable for all Missourians across the state.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, certainly I think we all agree. Certainly Missouri's voters agree. Yet there seems to be stirs in the legislature to deny that will of the people. Do you have any sense of that?
Well, I just don't know how they could do that.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, that's good. That's good. Good to hear.
Mainly because it's a situation where that the will of the people overwhelmingly support this issue, just like with right to work. And I just think that this is a situation where the Republican majority will be dead. They will be wrestling with a gorilla, and I think this is going to be hard press for them to turn back the clock on raising wages for working people in this state. Period.
Yeah. Well, let's hope so. And I would certainly hope that that we never have to face it again. Of course, I was part of that 1978 campaign to oppose. No, I'm thinking right to work now. I'm confusing the two. Okie doke, let's move forward with Proposition D, which was kind of a, from a personal perspective, I was sad to see it turned down. That would, of course, the gas tax to improve road conditions. I think that heavily impacts working people, and of course, the longer we delay it, the more it's going to cost.
Well, absolutely, and we know when I talk with the MoDOT director, we have $850 million worth of deferred maintenance in this state for highways and bridges. That's not new projects. That's not expansions of highways. That is infrastructure that we have currently across this state that is not being adequately taken care of, and what we see is we've got almost $1 billion worth of improvement that needs to happen that's critical for roadway safety. The second issue at hand is that we have the seventh largest highway system in the nation, and we are 49th in funding for highways in the nation. And so our funding and our highway system don't match, and that is becoming a problem. And we're on the verge of losing our federal match that we get from D.C. to keep our highways up. And so we haven't had an increase to the highway funding since the 1980s. And so this is a situation that is becoming more and more dire, and it's becoming a safety issue. If people drive along I-70, 71 Highway, and 435, 50 Highway in the Kansas City area, 470, you drive across bridges, and we drive across highways and systems that are in desperate need of repair, and that if we don't get that repair, your sons, your daughters, your mothers and fathers can be in terrible danger and face real safety issues moving forward as we get into the winter weather and we get into the seasons where roads are really needing to be repaired.
I spent a significant part of my life on Missouri's roads, and I can attest to that.
Yeah.
So well. Listen, moving on, some of the issues that were not on the ballot, but I certainly think it has an impact. We most recently in a 2-1 vote turned right to work away. Yet I'm hearing that there are clamors in the legislature to bring it back. And as I said, I was a part of that 1978 campaign to make Missouri a non-right to work state. And is there any evidence that they may want to tweak that?
I don't think that is likely, because it passed overwhelmingly 65-35 in this state, 65% to 35%. I think the Republicans know not to mess with right to work. I think Missourians send an overwhelmingly strong message that they do not want to be a right to work state. I think that showed that they knew that the polling was so strong for workers in this state. That is why they moved it from the November ballot, which it would have been on there with Claire McCaskill versus Josh Hawley, and they moved it to the August to mitigate any bump that Claire McCaskill could have received from a right to work being on the ballot and promoting working families in this state.
Okay, that's good. That means we're relatively safe there with another fight for right to work here. That's comforting. Medicare expansion has been a hot topic. Or the lack thereof, at least. What's the prognosis there?
I don't see that Medicare expansion will be on the ballot in this legislative term. Mainly just because of the legislature is just so ultra conservative, and it just doesn't make any sense. I mean, they call it Obamacare, whatever you want to call it. You have rural hospitals that are closing across the state because they don't have enough money to stay open and keep their doors open. And what that means is that you're going to be costing, the impact is you're going to cost people their lives. If you live in, you know, if you live in Lafayette County and the closest, you know, hospital you is 20 miles away, and then emergency when you've had a heart attack or a stroke, that is life-altering.
Life-threatening, right?
And so you are changing the destiny of many people, and you're sending people to die. I mean, you close these rural hospitals that are the only emergency rooms or the only areas where you have medical needs within miles and miles in some of these smaller cities across our state.
Indeed. Yeah, that's certainly a critical need there, but so often we see our legislature moving in opposite direction from the will of the people. I couldn't help but notice in looking at the House bills online, numerous attacks on prevailing wage. Can you share anything with our listeners about prevailing wages and where our legislature stands as it relates to that?
Well, right now we have continued to push against those issues of prevailing wage. Prevailing wage was not cut as deep as it could have been because some of our Democratic senators stood up to fight that. But I think it could be on the chopping block again this year. But prevailing wage really helps a lot of these local municipalities to stay competitive and keep costs down for a lot of these smaller cities. And paying a prevailing wage for local workers is good for the economy.
Yeah. Yeah, well, I would certainly think so. Yet, you know, again and again, we see our legislative bodies dominated by conservative interests that seem to move away from the will of the people. Some time ago, and I'm not sure, I kind of looked for it, there was some rather draconian attacks on unions, that union members would have to re-up every 2 years or something of that sort, and it was kind of in the news a little bit, then we never heard any more about it. Do you have any insights there?
Well, I don't. I have not heard anything about that, mm-hmm. But I can follow up, and I'd be willing to, you know, talk to your listeners about that at another point, but yes.
Mm-hmm. And certainly we would be concerned with that. It seems to me that was some legislation passed, and yet we never heard any more about it. So I thought it may have been tied up in the courts or something like that.
I have not heard about that. Uh-huh. I'm sorry, I have not heard about that, Mike. Uh-huh.
Yeah, and of course, everybody's concern is better schools, and we're seeing, unfortunately, we're seeing so many of our legislative bodies moving toward the charter schools and to limit public education in ways that, from my perspective, make it more difficult to educate children. Any insights
right
there? That's, of course, a big issue with working people.
Well, the last couple of years as it relates to education, you know, we have fully funded the education formula the last 2 years, and one thing that we're looking at doing now is how do we fund early childhood? I mean, that's going to be our biggest issue, and I think that immediately has a direct impact on working people who attend public schools, because we, you know, if you can get kids into the school system at 3 and 4 years old, I think they stand a better chance of being successful once they get into a full school system. The earlier you can get children into their school system, the better off they'll be.
Indeed. You know, I heard Tom Frank on radio this morning. Tom, of course, was the author of the, probably 8-10 years ago, What's the Matter with Kansas, the book that attempted to make some assessment of why Kansas voted in opposition to their own personal interests. And it seems to me that whatever is the matter with Kansas has spread to Missouri, because I see Missouri doing more and more of that. In other words, we vote for issues, and then we elect people that are not supportive of those issues. And any comments there? What's going on?
Well,
with that?
Michael, that's just the history of this state, where we continually vote for, you know, raising the minimum wage, and we vote for against right to work, but yet we vote for elected officials that don't share our interests. And we have a history of voting for people that don't share our interests, or vote for people who don't share our values, and we're voting against our own interests. Why anybody on November 6th could vote for Josh Hawley, somebody who's clearly anti-worker, who didn't support right to work, who supported right to work, and somebody who was against the worker who did not support raising the minimum wage, and those counties that went against right to work and went for providing a living wage clearly went against Senator McCaskill, who supported those issues. Mm-hmm. So we have a history of voting against our own self-interest, which is just, unfortunately, just not smart on our part. And we're surprised that, you know, that people show us who they really are, and then when they vote that way, we're shocked and angry.
Yeah, yeah. Well, absolutely. But all in all, I, from a worker perspective, was not overly joyed, but certainly pleased that we saw nationwide, we saw things that are indicative of perhaps that turning around a little bit. And, of course, I can cite the number of women involved, the number of young people involved, certainly the tenacity of those who stepped up to the plate to recognize their citizenship and realize that we cannot have a democracy unless we're all involved. So
right.
I'm encouraged. Representative McGee, I want to thank you for sharing your insights with the Heartland Labor Forum's community. And we certainly appreciate you being on tonight, and we appreciate all that you do in Jefferson City. So,
Thank you, Michael, for having me on. And, I enjoy the work that we do. And I don't know if your listeners know, but I was elected on Tuesday I'm the newest assistant Democratic leader in the House of Representatives in the Missouri legislature.
Yes, sir. Well, congratulations to you on that one. And let me say, keep up the good work.
Thank you so much, Mike.
You're listening to the Heartland Labor Forum, and we'll be right back after the following messages.
Friends, to please consider supporting KKFI during this year's combined federal campaign. That's CFC code 21994. Just a few dollars a week on payroll deductions won't mean much to you, but it'll mean big bucks to us at KKFI. So please consider supporting KKFI. That's agency code 21994.
Come on home. No, you don't have to be alone.
Support for KKFI provided by National Shows 2, presenting John Prine with special guest Connor Oberst at the Harvest Bank Theater at the Midland this Friday night, November 16th. Tickets are on sale now. More information and tickets available at MidlandKC.com.
Thanks to Stockyards Brewing Company presenting the KKFI Fall 2018 Band Auction. KKFI.org/band auction for complete schedule and pre-bidding information. The auction will begin this Friday, the 16th, in the afternoon, and end at 5 p.m. this Sunday, the 18th. So the deal is, bands perform live in KKFI studios. Bids are phoned in to 888-931-0901, and winning bidders schedule a two-hour performance with the band. Thanks again to Stockyards Brewing Company for supporting KKFI once again. KKFI.org/band auction for all the info, and thanks for 30 years of support.
Who's gonna drive you home tonight?
Did you know that you can donate that unwanted car, boat, truck, or motorcycle to KKFI and get a tax deduction for your donation? Find out more by calling 866-628-2277.
We eat the whole grains from our land. We've got the hip hopping wheat, can't be beat. We've got the hip hopping wheat, can't be beat. We've got the hip hopping wheat, can't be beat. We eat the whole grains from our land.
Welcome to the Heartland Labor Forum. My name is Chris Mann, and I'm your host for this segment. Have you had your oats this morning? That song you just heard was Go Wild with Whole Grains by the Whole Grain Food Society. We're going to explore tonight how an entrepreneur, Bob Moore of Bob's Red Mill, created a global company selling whole grains, and then, on his 81st birthday, told his employees he was giving the company to his employees. We'll explore what an ESOP is, Employee Stock Ownership Plan, compared to a worker cooperative, with our guest, Professor Eric Olson from the University of Missouri, Kansas City. Welcome, Professor.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
First, as a person myself who is a fan of natural foods, and as a person who also lived in the 60s and 70s, this book I would recommend is a good read. Briefly, the book traces Bob Moore's life and events during these years, and the years and the events in these years serve as backdrops for the way Bob's life evolved. He encounters multiple failures, but attempts to learn from them. His dream is to go into business with his father, but his father dies from a heart attack at the age of 49. He drops out of school, wrecks his car, loses girlfriends. He joins the Army and runs the store at the military base. He gets a series of jobs in service stations, JCPenney automotive shops, and finds he has a fascination with machinery. He failed at a service station ownership and then reads a book in a library about milling whole grains. Suffering from losses, he is forced he has no money to move to the countryside, where he experiences whole and nutritious vegetables, fruit, and whole grains. And that's his lifestyle. Bob says in an interview that he can still taste the first whole wheat loaf of bread that his wife prepared. His wife, Charlie, was influenced by Adele Davis and other nutritionists advocating high-fiber diets. Because he's thrifty, he constructed a building for his first mill out of scrap wood from subdivisions that were going strong in the suburbs around Portland, Oregon. Bob shaped and built his first natural foods mill out of this wood, which subsequently was burned to the ground, allegedly by a serial arsonist. At 60 years old, he rebuilt, salvaging the old stone millstones from the fire wreckage. Today, Bob's Red Mill is a global company, and many people have offered to buy him out who want the profit from his lifelong work. Interviews reveal that Bob carefully thought for 9 years before his 81st birthday that he would give the company to his employees. Let's listen to an interview excerpt from 1190 News Radio, KEX, from April 12, 2012.
America and America media is captivated by the Bob's Red Mill story, and I think I know why. It's because major corporations in America are going completely in a different direction. They don't seem to care much about their long-term employees. Everything is changing on the corporate front. Why have you been successful doing things the way you've done, giving back to your employees?
Well, Paul, I appreciate the fact that you see that, and yes, I have. I'm really a believer that we are our brother's keeper. I mean, it's part of the scriptures and some things that I believe in. So taking that responsibility seriously, giving the company to the employees through a stock ownership plan, it was part of my plan many years ago to make this happen, and it's in the process now. Believe it or not, in a few years, I won't own the company. My employees will, and I happen to have a company that's going to do just fine that way.
Is American business ever going to get back to that kind of thinking?
Well, I don't know, Paul. I think I'm influencing some people. I have an awful lot of people come to me and ask me for advice about the stock ownership plan and whatnot. So there's some interest out there. Let's hope so.
You're giving the company basically to the employees through the stock plan. I know a lot of guys, and what you're supposed to do with a very successful local business, although you're now global in scope, what you're supposed to do is sell that, sit back, and enjoy your millions through the retirement years. Why wasn't that an option for you?
I don't know. I can't retire. I don't know why. I was there this morning at 6 o'clock. I love my job. I love my people. I'm just surrounded with people that have the same excitement and the same appreciation of whole grain foods that I do. Danny, for instance, my very close partner and compatriot for over 30 years, he feels the same way I do. And I don't know, Paul. I'm so happy to.
He adores his people, and Ken, I won't ask Bob to address this. They seem to adore him, and we know some reasons why, but there's also some unknowns in that. I mean, this guy is beloved by every worker out there.
Well, it's a mutual love and respect that I found as I interviewed the employees. They call him their best friend. One of the employees, I'm sitting at her desk, and I see a picture of Bob on her desk. Now, he's the boss. How often do you see the picture of the boss on your desk? Yeah, you put it there. It's authentic. I mean, it's a love story. Really, this book is about love.
Corporate America seems to show longtime employees adore frequently, or they're bought out by another company that does. 2 years ago, at the age of 81, he gave his company back to the employees and asked Bob why he went this way.
Gee, I don't know, Paul. My people didn't come to me over this. It was a sense of responsibility my wife and I, Charlie, felt was just part of what we needed in our life. And I've had plenty of opportunities to sell Bob's Red Mill. A lot of competitors and different people have asked to buy the company. But most of the time that throws your employees, I mean, they just find something different to do because they close companies and whatnot. This way, we're going to remain an entity, and I think it's a very important way to go.
So what's the takeaway from this book, your company, what you've done there? What can we learn from it? What's the message?
Oh, dear. You're going to how long have we got? You're your brother's keeper. I don't know how else to place the thing, Paul. You need to be responsible. If you're going to be the owner, the driving force in your business, I think it's important that you feel a sense of responsibility to others besides yourself. And do I work at it? Yes. Do I believe it? I truly, truly believe in the things that I've done. And I don't know why other people can't begin to think that way instead of just simply, how fast can I make a dollar?
So this brings us to tonight's exploration of what it means both for corporate America and for working people to have businesses that are employee-owned. Our guest, Eric Olson, will help us clarify the types of ownership that workers can have today. Eric, are Americans justified in wanting to be their own boss and wanting to be in business for themselves? And can you tell us a little bit about your background and experience in all of this?
Sure. I'll start with that last part. I'm a professor in the economics department at the University of Missouri, Kansas City. I'm also a senior fellow at the Institute for the Study of Employee Ownership and Profit Sharing at Rutgers University in New Brunswick. So I've been working on these topics for quite a while, and so I'm happy to be here to be able to speak with your listeners about this. The idea of being our own boss is something that's deeply ingrained in the United States psyche. We began as a country where people were primarily self-employed unless they were in the American South, in which they were owned by a slave master. But in we seem to have fought a civil war to put an end to that system of oppression now. But and we celebrate still the idea that we have that we're a nation of people who are independent and seek to be in control of their own working lives. But what we see is that in the research, if you give people some control or some participation in the way it is that they manage their work, they get much greater satisfaction out of it than if they just take direction from somebody. So participation in management has a significant improvement in the way people experience it and also the way that they behave in the workplace.
Hmm. Yes. So do most people now who go start a business succeed at that? Is it difficult? It certainly seemed hard for Bob Moore.
Yeah. Most new businesses fail. That's well established empirically. There's something what's referred to as the liability of newness. The liability of newness is that most new businesses, they don't have well-established relationships with their suppliers. They don't have well-established relationship with their customers. They're still trying to figure out the best way to do what it is that they do. And so the average lifespan of a new business is about 3 years in the United States. Turns out, since we're on the topic, that for a worker cooperative, the average lifespan of a new worker cooperative is actually longer than the expected lifespan of a conventional corporation or a conventional business, both in the short term, the medium term, and probably in the long term as well. Once established, they survive at least as well or better than conventional firms do. Though you do need to recognize that most new businesses fail, whether they're worker cooperatives or whether they're conventionally owned firms.
Interesting. Yeah. So what exactly is an employee stock ownership plan, an ESOP? What Kansas City companies have ESOPs?
Sure. Yeah, I mean, ESOPs are very common. There's about 10,000 ESOPs in place in the United States now. The ESOP itself by law, it's a retirement plan. It was created by ERISA, the law that created, for example, in 1974, ERISA law, which created 401ks and 403bs, and also governs defined benefit pension plans as well. So essentially, at the core of an employee stock ownership plan is what's referred to as an employee stock ownership trust. And the trust holds the ownership of the equity of the company in trust for the employees. And the employees have the status of what's known as a beneficial owner, which is that they receive the benefits of the trust. So the primary benefit that we would be talking about in the ownership of the equity of the company would be the profits that are going to be distributed to the owners of the company, as the shares themselves can increase in value. So once an employee stock ownership plan is established, the trust begins to acquire the assets of the firm. In this example, in the Bob's Red Mill example, as I understand it, 100% of the equity of the firm was transferred into the ESOP plan and essentially became the property of the people who were working at the company through the trust, as them being beneficiaries of the trust. So that's the primary idea behind what an ESOP is. The central mechanism is the idea of the trust and that acquiring the assets of the company and operating then for the benefit of the employees.
So comparatively, what is an employee cooperative? How many exist in the United States, and what's the advantages?
Sure. So worker cooperative, it's interesting because they're I don't know. If you'd asked me this question 10 years ago, I would say that there's a significant difference between worker cooperatives and ESOPs. But over the last 10 years, in part because of the interaction between people who are associated with this, like the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, which is located out in the Bay Area in San Francisco, and the ESOP Association, which is in Washington, D.C., there's been sort of connections between them and sharing of ideas and practices that work. The basic idea of a worker cooperative, though, is that it typically does not involve the trust mechanism. And what it is that the worker members of the worker cooperative own the equity of the firm directly, and they have both control rights, meaning the ability to dictate the management of the firm either directly or indirectly through representative representative management. But they own the equity of the firm directly, and therefore they receive the profits of the firm directly, but they also get to participate in management and either directly manage or by electing someone decide who it is, how the management's going to take place. And the number of worker co-ops in the United States, there's about 400 of them today, and you find them in a variety of different fields and different areas geographically. We do see clusters of them, for example, in Massachusetts, in California, also Madison, Wisconsin, growing in places like Minneapolis and Austin, Minnesota, also growing in places like New York City, Cincinnati, Ohio, and most notably in Cleveland, Ohio, where the Evergreen Cooperative group of cooperatives was established about 10 years ago as well as an urban core development project to try to provide employment for people in the urban core.
Hmm. Okay. So we're nearing the end of our time here. Mm-hmm. Do you see cooperatives blossoming, rising, or mm-hmm. diminishing? And what can workers and their unions, how can they get a better fair shake?
Okay. Yeah, there's a tremendous amount of energy around worker cooperatives today. And in part, that is because of the real concerted effort that's been made by, for example, the U.S. Federation of Worker Cooperatives, who was established in 2004. So they've only been around for about 14 years. But and there's much longer, well-established cooperative federations in many of the European countries. The United States is just really getting on board with this. And so we see new cooperative developments, initiatives taking place, again, in a number of cities. New York has devoted significant resources to it, several million dollars to co-op development there. Mm-hmm. Cleveland is a notable one. Austin, again, is a notable one. Local economic developers are the other people who are playing an important role in these co-op development initiatives. You asked about unions. There was an initiative. It was the U.S. Steelworkers entered into an agreement to try to develop worker cooperatives in the United States with the Mondragon Cooperative Corporation from the Basque Country of Spain, which is the largest and most established cooperative network in the world, and really kind of a model for doing co-op development. Not much has come out of that, and we're looking to see more involvement of the union movement in that. There is a notable cluster in Cincinnati. The union co-op movement in Cincinnati is gaining steam, and they have some exploratory projects to try to get some initiatives off the ground as well. But I think that's an important area of convergence between working people and the organizations that represent them, and trying to think about new institutional forms to try to provide a large number of people with that opportunity to work in a worker co-op.
Okay, and thank you. We are out of time. I just wanted to add, from learning about Bob Moore's life and struggle to produce healthful products, we can all take to heart Bob's own words when interviewed about his decision to share his wealth with his employees. We are all our brother's keepers. Thanks to Eric Olson, our guest, and Bill Claus for engineering. Good night.
Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up, stand up for your right. Get up, stand up.
Good evening, Kansas City. This is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Today I wanted to talk a little bit about asylum and the caravan of asylum seekers that are heading towards the border. The president has been tweeting a lot about this, and even has gone as far to send military troops to the border to quote-unquote secure the border from these poor, hungry, tired asylum seekers that are mostly coming from Central America in order to try to seek protection in the United States under our asylum laws from the crime that has been largely caused by United States foreign policy in Central America. The president likes to demonize immigrants, and has done a very good job since he started being president in 2017 of attacking immigrants, immigration, and the whole system of due process. His strongest attacks have come in the form of attacking asylum seekers. So I wanted to clear up a few misconceptions about asylum seekers and the process. First of all, asylum seekers are not undocumented immigrants. They are not trying to enter the country illegally. If you are coming to the country to seek asylum, that is, in fact, the way that you apply for asylum. You show up at the border, or a point of entry, and you tell the CBP agent, which is Customs and Border Patrol, that you are afraid to return to your country and you wish to seek asylum in the United States. Now, you can also seek asylum in the United States if you're already here and something has happened in your country to cause you now to not be able to go back. A lot of times this happens with students who have come to the United States to go to university, and then something happens in their country, there's like a coup or something like that, and now it is unsafe for them to go back. The point is, the right to seek asylum is different from other immigration issues that we are facing. The president also likes to make it seem that asylum is something that's just handed out like candy, that it's something really easy to get and that there's a lot of fraud. The fact is, asylum is extremely difficult to get, and a very low percentage of asylum applications are granted every year. In order to apply for asylum, people have to generally show five things. Now, this is sort of an oversimplification, but this is a good overview of the understanding of asylum law. You have to show that something happened, that you were persecuted in some way, that you were harmed or threatened, or in some other way persecuted. You have to show that the person or the group of people that did that persecuting are a person or a group of people that the government is unable or unwilling to control. Third, you have to show that those uncontrollable people that hurt you did so because of something specific about you, the person applying for asylum, because of race, religion, national origin, political opinion, or because of your membership in a particular social group. Now, this can sometimes take the form of, I worked in an opposition party, and when the person gained power in the country, and now they are persecuting the people that worked in opposition of him. It can also come in the form of, like, let's say, religious persecution. There is a religious government, for example, and a person that is a member of a minority religion in the country maybe is being persecuted by the religion that is in the majority or in power. One of the most complicated areas of immigration law comes around the last one, which is particular social group. Now, this is something that a person belongs to and is recognizable within the country. It's not something that necessarily you see, but it's a group that exists within the country. LGBT folks have been considered a particular social group, former member of military, members of family. Those are examples of some particular social group. After that, you have to show that you cannot internally relocate and solve the problem, and then if you return, you are going to suffer similar persecution, or that you have a well-founded fear. These are extremely difficult cases to win. In fact, somewhere around 30 to 35% of cases that are filed in immigration court win each year, meaning that more than 70% usually of cases do not win in court. So the fact is, if this caravan of asylum seekers comes up to the United States border and asks for asylum, not letting them go through our process for asylum is not only a violation of our personal national law, but also a violation of a number of treaties. This use of, or the show of force at the border, is completely overblown with the situation. What they need to be doing is stationing more asylum officers, judges, and lawyers at the border in order to help process people when they come. That's all the time we have for today. This is a very complicated subject. I could talk for probably an hour just on this all by itself. But hopefully that gives you a little bit of insight into what's going on and why the news about this issue is so misleading. My name is Angie Williams with the Law Offices of Angela L. Williams with another edition of Know Your Rights. Be safe, Kansas City.
And now for the calendar, this week's calendar, Movement. Movement Beer, a fundraiser for the Poor People's Campaign, Heartland Center for Jobs and Freedom and Stand Up KC on Thursday, November 15th from 5 to 8 p.m. at the Beer Station, 120 East Gregory Boulevard. So I'm going to shout out to John Couture, who works there. Surge KC, November Mass Meeting, I Voted, What Now? Monday, November 19th, 6:30 to 8:30 at St. Mark's Hope and Peace Church, 3800 Troost, KC Mo. Kansas City Jobs with Justice Annual Scrooge Party, a holiday party with an attitude. Tuesday, December 4th from 5 to 7 p.m. IBEW Local 124 Hall, 301 East 103rd Terrace in Kansas City, Missouri. So who will win the Scrooge of the Year for 2018? Online voting begins November 13th at mojwj.org. That's mojwj.org. So thank you so much for tuning in the Heartland Labor Forum. Next week, we'll replay a previous show, How We Defeated Right to Work and Now What. Very good discussion. And thanks to our engineer, Bill Claus. Wait, that's me. Well, I'm welcome. Thank you. Jen Zaman, you are missed. Stay tuned for the Thursday night special right here on KKFI Kansas City Community Radio.